Disc 3.
His white jacket was purple under the arms. He must drink a lot of wine. Or wear purple undershirts. Let's ask him. No, he's too tired. The train stopped for half an hour at Bordeaux, and we went out through the station for a little walk. There was not time to get into the town. Afterward, we passed through the Landes and watched the sunset. There were wide fire gaps cut through the pines, and you could look up them like avenues and see wooded hills way off. About 7:30 we had dinner and watched the country through the open window in the diner. It was all sandy pine country, full of heather. There were little clearings with houses in them, and once in a while we passed a sawmill. It got dark, and we could feel the country hot and sandy and dark outside of the window, and about 9 o'clock we got into Bayonne. The man and his wife and Hubert all shook hands with us. They were going on to La Négresse to change for Biarritz. "Well, I hope you have lots of luck," he said. "Be careful about those bullfights." "Maybe we'll see you at Biarritz," Hubert said. We got off with our bags and rod cases and passed through the dock station and out to the lights and the line of cabs and hotel buses. There, standing with the hotel runners, was Robert Cohn. He did not see us at first. Then he started forward. "Hello, Jake. Have a good trip?" "Fine," I said. "This is Bill Gorton." "How are you?" "Come on," said Robert. "I've got a cab." He was a little nearsighted. I'd never noticed it before. He was looking at Bill, trying to make him out. He was shy, too. "We'll go up to my hotel. It's all right. It's quite nice." We got into the cab, and the cabman put the bags up on the seat beside him and climbed up and cracked his whip, and we drove over the dark bridge and into the town. "I'm awfully glad to meet you," Robert said to Bill. "I've heard so much about you from Jake, and I've read your books. Did you get my line, Jake?" The cab stopped in front of the hotel, and we all got out and went in. It was a nice hotel, and the people at the desk were very cheerful, and we each had a good small room. Chapter 10. In the morning it was bright and they were sprinkling the streets of the town, and we all had breakfast in a cafe. Bayonne is a nice town. It is like a very clean Spanish town, and it is on a big river. Already, so early in the morning, it was very hot on the bridge across the river. We walked out on the bridge and then took a walk through the town. I was not at all sure Mike's rods would come from Scotland in time, so we hunted a tackle store and finally bought a rod for Bill upstairs over a dry goods store. The man who sold the tackle was out, and we had to wait for him to come back. Finally, he came in, and we bought a pretty good rod cheap and two landing nets. We went out into the street again and took a look at the cathedral. Cohn made some remark about it being a very good example of something or other, I forget what. It seemed like a nice cathedral, nice and dim, like Spanish churches. Then we went up past the old fort and out to the local Syndicat d'Initiative office, where the bus was supposed to start from. There, they told us, the bus service did not start until the 1st of July. We found out at the tourist office what we ought to pay for a motor car to Pamplona, and hired one at a big garage just around the corner from the municipal theater for 400 francs. The car was to pick us up at the hotel in 40 minutes, and we stopped at the cafe on the square where we had eaten breakfast and had a beer. It was hot, but the town had a cool, fresh, early morning smell, and it was pleasant sitting in the cafe. A breeze started to blow, and you could feel that the air came from the sea. There were pigeons out in the square, and the houses were a yellow, sun-baked color, and I did not want to leave the cafe. But we had to go to the hotel to get our bags packed and pay the bill. We paid for the beers, we matched, and I think Cohn paid, and went up to the hotel. It was only 16 francs apiece for Bill and me, with 10% added for the service, and we had the bags sent down and waited for Robert Cohn. While we were waiting, I saw a cockroach on the parquet floor that must have been at least 3 inches long. I pointed him out to Bill and then put my shoe on him. We agreed he must have just come in from the garden. It was really an awfully clean hotel. Cohn came down finally, and we all went out to the car. It was a big closed car, with a driver and a white duster with blue collar and cuffs, and we had him put the back of the car down. He piled in the bags, and we started off up the street and out of the town. We passed some lovely gardens and had a good look back at the town, and then we were out in the country, green and rolling, and the road climbing all the time. We passed lots of Basques with oxen or cattle hauling carts along the road, and nice farmhouses, low roofs, and all white plastered. In the Basque country, the land all looks very rich and green, and the houses and villages look well off and clean. Every village had a pelota court, and on some of them kids were playing in the hot sun. There were signs on the walls of the churches saying it was forbidden to play pelota against them, and the houses in the villages had red-tiled roofs. And then the road turned off and commenced to climb, and we were going way up close along a hillside, with a valley below and hills stretched off back toward the sea. You couldn't see the sea. It was too far away. You could only see hills and more hills, and you knew where the sea was. We crossed the Spanish frontier. There was a little stream and a bridge, and Spanish carabineers, with patent leather Bonaparte hats and short guns on their backs, on one side, and on the other, fat Frenchmen in kippies and mustaches. They only opened one bag and took the passports in and looked at them. There was a general store and inn on each side of the line. The chauffeur had to go in and fill out some papers about the car, and we got out and went over to the stream to see if there were any trout. Bill tried to talk some Spanish to one of the carabineers, but it did not go very well. Robert Cohn asked, pointing with his finger, if there were any trout in the stream, and the carabineer said yes, but not many. I asked him if he ever fished, and he said no, that he didn't care for it. Just then an old man with long sunburned hair and beard and clothes that looked as though they were made of gunny sacking came striding up to the bridge. He was carrying a long staff, and he had a kid slung on his back, tied by the four legs, the head hanging down. The carabineer waved him back with his sword. The man turned without saying anything and started back up the white road into Spain. "What's the matter with the old one?" I asked. "He hasn't got any passport." I offered the guard a cigarette. He took it and thanked me. "What will he do?" I asked. The guard spat in the dust. "Oh, he'll just wade across the stream." "Do you have much smuggling?" "Oh," he said, "they go through." The chauffeur came out, folding up the papers and putting them in the inside pocket of his coat. We all got in the car and it started up the white dusty road into Spain. For a while the country was much as it had been. Then, climbing all the time, we crossed the top of a col, the road winding back and forth on itself, and then it was really Spain. There were long brown mountains and a few pines and far-off forests of beech trees on some of the mountainsides. The road went along the summit of the col and then dropped down, and the driver had to honk and slow up and turn out to avoid running into two donkeys that were sleeping in the road. We came down out of the mountains and through an oak forest, and there were white cattle grazing in the forest. Down below there were grassy plains and clear streams, and then we crossed a stream and went through a gloomy little village and started to climb again. We climbed up and up and crossed another high col and turned along it, and the road ran down to the right, and we saw a whole new range of mountains off to the south, all brown and baked-looking and furrowed in strange shapes. After a while we came out of the mountains, and there were trees along both sides of the road, and a stream and ripe fields of grain. And the road went on, very white and straight ahead, and then lifted to a little rise, and off on the left was a hill with an old castle, with buildings close around it, and a field of grain going right up to the walls and shifting in the wind. I was up in front with the driver, and I turned around. Robert Cohn was asleep, but Bill looked and nodded his head. Then we crossed a wide plain, and there was a big river off on the right, shining in the sun from between the line of trees, and away off you could see the plateau of Pamplona rising out of the plain, and the walls of the city, and the great brown cathedral, and the broken skyline of the other churches. In back of the plateau were the mountains, and every way you looked there were other mountains, and ahead the road stretched out white across the plain going toward Pamplona. We came into the town on the other side of the plateau, the road slanting up steeply and dustily with shade trees on both sides, and then leveling out through the new part of town they are building up outside the old walls. We passed the bullring, high and white and concrete-looking in the sun, and then came into the big square by a side street and stopped in front of the Hotel Montoya. The driver helped us down with the bags. There was a crowd of kids watching the car, and the square was hot, and the trees were green, and the flags hung on their staffs, and it was good to get out of the sun and under the shade of the arcade that runs all the way around the square. Montoya was glad to see us, and shook hands and gave us good rooms looking out on the square. and then we washed and cleaned up and went downstairs in the dining room for lunch. The driver stayed for lunch, too, and afterward we paid him and he started back to Bayonne. There are two dining rooms in the Montoya. One is upstairs on the second floor and looks out on the square. The other is down one floor, below the level of the square, and has a door that opens on the back street that the bulls pass along when they run through the streets early in the morning on their way to the ring. It is always cool in the downstairs dining room, and we had a very good lunch. The first meal in Spain was always a shock, with the hors d'oeuvres, an egg course, two meat courses, vegetables, salad, and dessert and fruit. You have to drink plenty of wine to get it all down. Robert Cohn tried to say he did not want any of the second meat course, but we would not interpret for him, and so the waitress brought him something else as a replacement, a plate of cold meats, I think. Cohn had been rather nervous ever since we had met at Bayonne. He did not know whether we knew Brett had been with him at San Sebastian, and it made him rather awkward. "Well," I said, "Brett and Mike ought to get in tonight." "I'm not sure they'll come," Cohn said. "Why not?" Bill said. "Of course they'll come." "They're always late," I said. "I rather think they're not coming," Robert Cohn said. He said it with an air of superior knowledge that irritated both of us. "I'll bet you 50 pesetas they're here tonight," Bill said. He always bets when he is angered, and so he usually bets foolishly. "I'll take it," Cohn said. "Good. You remember it, Jake, 50 pesetas. "I'll remember it myself," Bill said. I saw he was angry and wanted to smooth him down. "It's a sure thing they'll come," I said, "but maybe not tonight." "Want to call it off?" Cohn asked. "No, why should I? Make it 100 if you like." "All right, I'll take that." "That's enough," I said, "or you'll have to make a book and give me some of it." "I'm satisfied," Cohn said. He smiled. "You'll probably win it back at bridge anyway." "You haven't got it yet," Bill said. We went out to walk around under the arcade to the Café Iruña for coffee. Cohn said he was going over and get a shave. "Say," Bill said to me, "have I got any chance on that bet?" "You've got a rotten chance. They've never been on time anywhere. If their money doesn't come, it's a cinch they won't get in tonight." I was sorry as soon as I opened my big mouth, but I had to call him. "He's all right, I guess, but where does he get this inside stuff? Mike and Brett fixed it up with us about coming down here." I saw Cohn coming over across the square. "Here he comes." "Well, let him not get superior and Jewish." "The barbershop's closed," Cohn said. "It's not open till 4. We had coffee at the Iruña, sitting in comfortable wicker chairs looking out from the cool of the arcade at the big square. After a while, Bill went to write some letters and Cohn went over to the barbershop. It was still closed, so he decided to go up to the hotel and get a bath, and I sat out in front of the cafe and then went for a walk in the town. It was very hot, but I kept on the shady side of the streets and went through the market and had a good time seeing the town again. I went to the Ayuntamiento and found the old gentleman who subscribes for the bullfight tickets for me every year, and he had gotten the money I sent him from Paris and renewed my subscriptions, so that was all set. He was the archivist, and all the archives of the town were in his office. That has nothing to do with the story. Anyway, his office had a green baize door and a big wooden door, and when I went out I left him sitting among the archives that covered all the walls, and I shut both the doors, and as I went out of the building into the street, the porter stopped me to brush off my coat. "You must have been in a motor car," he said. The back of the collar and the upper part of the shoulders were gray with dust. "From Bayonne." "Well, well," he said, "I knew you were in a motor car from the way the dust was." So I gave him 2 copper coins. At the end of the street I saw the cathedral and walked up toward it. The first time I ever saw it I thought the facade was ugly, but I liked it now. I went inside. It was dim and dark, and the pillars went high up, and there were people praying, and it smelt of incense, and there were some wonderful big windows. I knelt and started to pray, and prayed for everybody I thought of, Brett and Mike and Bill and Robert Cohn and myself and all the bullfighters, separately for the ones I liked, and lumping all the rest. Then I prayed for myself again, and while I was praying for myself I found I was getting sleepy, so I prayed that the bullfights would be good, and that it would be a fine fiesta, and that we would get some fishing. I wondered if there was anything else I might pray for, and I thought I would like to have some money, so I prayed that I would make a lot of money. and then I started to think how I would make it, and thinking of making money reminded me of the Count, and I started wondering about where he was, and regretting I hadn't seen him since that night in Montmartre, and about something funny Brett told me about him. And as all the time I was kneeling with my forehead on the wood in front of me and was thinking of myself as praying, I was a little ashamed and regretted that I was such a rotten Catholic, but realized there was nothing I could do about it, at least for a while, and maybe never. But that anyway, it was a grand religion, and I only wished I felt religious, and maybe I would the next time. And then I was out in the hot sun on the steps of the cathedral, and the forefingers and the thumb of my right hand were still damp, and I felt them dry in the sun. The sunlight was hot and hard, and I crossed over beside some buildings and walked back along side streets to the hotel. At dinner that night, we found that Robert Cohn had taken a bath, had had a shave and a haircut and a shampoo, and something put on his hair afterward to make it stay down. He was nervous, and I did not try to help him any. The train was due in at 9 o'clock from San Sebastian, and if Brett and Mike were coming, they would be on it. At 9:20, we were not half through dinner. Robert Cohn got up from the table and said he would go to the station. I said I would go with him, just to devil him. Bill said he would be damned if he would leave his dinner. I said we would be right back. We walked to the station. I was enjoying Cohn's nervousness. I hoped Brett would be on the train. At the station, the train was late, and we sat on a baggage truck and waited outside in the dark. I have never seen a man in civil life as nervous as Robert Cohn, nor as eager. I was enjoying it. It was lousy to enjoy it, but I felt lousy. Cohn had a wonderful quality of bringing out the worst in anybody. After a while, we heard the train whistle way off below on the other side of the plateau, and then we saw the headlight coming up the hill. We went inside the station and stood with a crowd of people just back of the gates, and the train came in and stopped, and everybody started coming out through the gates. They were not in the crowd. We waited till everybody had gone through and out of the station and gotten into buses, or taken cabs, or were walking with their friends or relatives through the dark into the town. "I knew they wouldn't come," Robert said. We were going back to the hotel. "I thought they might," I said. Bill was eating fruit when we came in and finishing a bottle of wine. "Didn't come, eh?" "No." "Do you mind if I give you that 100 pesetas in the morning, Cohn?" Bill asked. "I haven't changed any money here yet." "Oh, forget about it," Cohn said. "Let's bet on something else. Can you bet on bullfights?" "You could," Bill said, "but you don't need to." "It would be like betting on the war," I said. "You don't need any economic interest." "I'm very curious to see them," Robert said. Montoya came up to our table. He had a telegram in his hand. "It's for you." He handed it to me. It read, "Stopped Night, San Sebastian." "It's from them," I said. I put it in my pocket. Ordinarily, I should have handed it over. "They've stopped over in San Sebastian," I said. "Send their regards to you." Why I felt that impulse to devil him, I do not know. Of course, I do know. I was blind, unforgivingly jealous of what had happened to him. The fact that I took it as a matter of course did not alter that any. I certainly did hate him. I do not think I ever really hated him until he had that little spell of superiority at lunch. That, and when he went through all that barbering. So I put the telegram in my pocket. The telegram came to me anyway. "Well," I said, "we ought to pull out on the noon bus for Burgate. They can follow us if they get in tomorrow night." There were only two trains up from San Sebastian, an early morning train and the one we had just met. "That sounds like a good idea," Cohn said. "The sooner we get on the stream, the better." "It's all one to me when we start," Bill said. "The sooner the better." We sat in the Irunya for a while and had coffee and then took a little walk out to the bull ring and across the field and under the trees at the edge of the cliff and looked down at the river in the dark, and I turned in early. Bill and Cohn stayed out in the café quite late, I believe, because I was asleep when they came in. In the morning I bought 3 tickets for the bus to Burgate. It was scheduled to leave at 2 o'clock. There was nothing earlier. I was sitting over at the Irunya reading the papers when I saw Robert Cohn coming across the square. He came up to the table and sat down in one of the wicker chairs. "This is a comfortable café," he said. "Did you have a good night, Jake?" "I slept like a log." "I didn't sleep very well. Bill and I were out late, too." "Where were you?" "Here." And after it shut, we went over to that other café. The old man there speaks German and English." "The Café Suisse." "That's it. He seems like a nice old fellow. I think it's a better cafe than this one. It's not so good in the daytime, I said. Too hot. By the way, I got the bus tickets. I'm not going up today. You and Bill go on ahead. I've got your ticket. Give it to me. I'll get the money back. It's 5 pesetas. Robert Cohn took out a silver 5 peseta piece and gave it to me. I ought to stay, he said. You see, I'm afraid there's some sort of misunderstanding. Why, I said. They may not come here for 3 or 4 days now if they start on parties at San Sebastian. Well, that's just it, said Robert. I'm afraid they expected to meet me at San Sebastian, and that's why they stopped over. What makes you think that? Well, I wrote suggesting it to Brett. Why in hell didn't you stay there and meet them then? I started to say, but I stopped. I thought that idea would come to him by itself, but I do not believe it ever did. He was being confidential now, and it was giving him pleasure to be able to talk with the understanding that I knew there was something between him and Brett. Well, Bill and I will go up right after lunch, I said. I wish I could go. We've been looking forward to this fishing all winter. He was being sentimental about it. But I ought to stay. I really ought. As soon as they come, I'll bring them right up. Let's find Bill. I want to go over to the barber shop. See you at lunch. I found Bill up in his room. He was shaving. Oh, yes, he told me all about it last night, Bill said. He's a great little confider. He said he had a date with Brett at San Sebastian. The lying bastard. Oh, no, said Bill. Don't get sore. Don't get sore at this stage of the trip. How did you ever happen to know this fellow anyway? Don't rub it in. Bill looked around, half-shaved, and then went on talking into the mirror while he lathered his face. Didn't you send him with a letter to me in New York last winter? Thank God I'm a traveling man. Haven't you got some more Jewish friends you could bring along? He rubbed his chin with his thumb, looked at it, and then started scraping again. You've got some fine ones yourself. Oh, yes, I've got some darbs, but not alongside of this Robert Cohn. Funny thing is, he's nice, too. I like him, but he's just so awful. He can be damn nice. I know it. That's the terrible part. I laughed. Yes, go on and laugh, said Bill. You weren't out with him last night until 2 o'clock. Was he very bad? Awful. What's all this about him and Brett, anyway? Did she ever have anything to do with him? He raised his chin up and pulled it from side to side. Sure, she went down to San Sebastian with him. What a damn fool thing to do. Why did she do that? She wanted to get out of town, and she can't go anywhere alone. She said she thought it would be good for him. What bloody fool things people do. Why didn't she go off with some of her own people? Or you, he slurred that over. Or me. Why not me? He looked at his face carefully in the glass, put a big dab of lather on each cheekbone. It's an honest face. It's a face any woman would be safe with. She'd never seen it. She should have. All women should see it. It's a face that ought to be thrown on every screen in the country. Every woman ought to be given a copy of this face as she leaves the altar. Mothers should tell their daughters about this face. My son, he pointed the razor at me, go west with this face and grow up with the country. He ducked down to the bowl, rinsed his face with cold water, put on some alcohol, and then looked at himself carefully in the glass, pulling down his long upper lip. My God, he said, isn't it an awful face? He looked in the glass. And as for this Robert Cohn, Bill said, he makes me sick, and he can go to hell, and I'm damn glad he's staying here so we won't have him fishing with us. You're damn right. We're going trout fishing. We're going trout fishing in the Irrawaddy River. And we're going to get tight now at lunch on the wine of the country and then take a swell bus ride. Come on, let's go over to the Urunia and start, I said. Chapter 11. It was baking hot in the square when we came out after lunch with our bags and the rod case to go to Burgate. People were on top of the bus and others were climbing up a ladder. Bill went up, and Robert sat beside Bill to save a place for me, and I went back in the hotel to get a couple of bottles of wine to take with us. When I came out, the bus was crowded. Men and women were sitting on all the baggage and boxes on top, and the women all had their fans going in the sun. It certainly was hot. Robert climbed down, and I fitted into the place he had saved on the one wooden seat that ran across the top. Robert Cohn stood in the shade of the arcade waiting for us to start. A Basque with a big leather wine bag in his lap lay across the top of the bus in front of our seat, leaning back against our legs. He offered the wineskin to Bill and to me, and when I tipped it up to drink, he imitated the sound of a klaxon motor horn so well and so suddenly that I spilled some of the wine, and everybody laughed. He apologized and made me take another drink. He made the klaxon again a little later, and it fooled me the second time. He was very good at it. The Basques liked it. The man next to Bill was talking to him in Spanish, and Bill was not getting it, so he offered the man one of the bottles of wine. The man waved it away. He said it was too hot, and he had drunk too much at lunch. When Bill offered the bottle the second time, he took a long drink, and then the bottle went all over that part of the bus. Everyone took a drink very politely, and then they made us cork it up and put it away. They all wanted us to drink from their leather wine bottles. They were peasants going up into the hills. Finally, after a couple more false klaxons, the bus started, and Robert Cohn waved goodbye to us, and all the Basques waved goodbye to him. As soon as we started out on the road outside of town, it was cool. It felt nice riding high up and close under the trees. The bus went quite fast and made a good breeze, and as we went out along the road with the dust powdering the trees and down the hill, we had a fine view back through the trees of the town rising up from the bluff above the river. The Basque lying against my knees pointed out the view with the neck of the wine bottle and winked at us. He nodded his head. "Pretty nice, eh?" "These Basques are swell people," Bill said. The Basque lying against my legs was tanned the color of saddle leather. He wore a black smock like all the rest. There were wrinkles in his tanned neck. He turned around and offered his wine bag to Bill. Bill handed him one of our bottles. The Basque wagged a forefinger at him and handed the bottle back, slapping in the cork with the palm of his hand. He shoved the wine bag up. "Arriba! Arriba!" he said. "Lift it up!" Bill raised the wineskin and let the stream of wine spurt out and into his mouth. His head tipped back. When he stopped drinking and tipped the leather bottle down, a few drops ran down his chin. "No, no," several Basques said. "Not like that." One snatched the bottle away from the owner, who was himself about to give a demonstration. He was a young fellow, and he held the wine bottle at full arm's length and raised it high up, squeezing the leather bag with his hand so the stream of wine hissed into his mouth. He held the bag out there, the wine making a flat, hard trajectory into his mouth, and he kept on swallowing smoothly and regularly. "Hey!" the owner of the bottle shouted. "Whose wine is that?" The drinker waggled his little finger at him and smiled at us with his eyes. Then he bit the stream off sharp, made a quick lift with the wine bag, and lowered it down to the owner. He winked at us. The owner shook the wineskin sadly. We passed through a town and stopped in front of the posada, and the driver took on several packages. Then we started on again, and outside the town the road commenced to mount. We were going through farming country with rocky hills that sloped down into the fields. The grain fields went up the hillsides. Now, as we went higher, there was a wind blowing the grain. The road was white and dusty, and the dust rose under the wheels and hung in the air behind us. The road climbed up into the hills and left the rich grain fields below. Now there were only patches of grain on the bare hillsides and on each side of the watercourses. We turned sharply out to the side of the road to give room to pass to a long string of six mules, following one after the other, hauling a high-hooded wagon loaded with freight. The wagon and the mules were covered with dust. Close behind was another string of mules and another wagon. This was loaded with lumber, and the arriero driving the mules leaned back and put on the thick wooden brakes as we passed. Up here the country was quite barren, and the hills were rocky and hard-baked clay furrowed by the rain. We came around a curve into a town, and on both sides opened out a sudden green valley. A stream went through the center of the town, and fields of grapes touched the houses. The bus stopped in front of a posada, and many of the passengers got down, and a lot of the baggage was unstrapped from the roof from under the big tarpaulins and lifted down. Bill and I got down and went into the posada. There was a low, dark room with saddles and harness and hay forks made of white wood and clusters of canvas rope-soled shoes and hams and slabs of bacon and white garlics and long sausages hanging from the roof. It was cool and dusky, and we stood in front of a long wooden counter with two women behind it serving drinks. Behind them were shelves stacked with supplies and goods. We each had an aguardiente and paid 40 centimes for the two drinks. I gave the woman 50 centimes to make a tip, and she gave me back the copper piece, thinking I had misunderstood the price. Two of our Basques came in and insisted on buying a drink. So they bought a drink, and then we bought a drink, and then they slapped us on the back and bought another drink. Then we bought, and then we all went out into the sunlight and the heat and climbed back on top of the bus. There was plenty of room now for everyone to sit on the seat, and the Basque who had been lying on the tin roof now sat between us. The woman who had been serving drinks came out wiping her hands on her apron and talking to somebody inside the bus. Then the driver came out swinging two flat leather mail pouches and climbed up, and everybody waving, we started off. The road left the green valley at once, and we were up in the hills again. Bill and the wine bottle Basque were having a conversation. A man leaned over from the other side of the seat and asked in English, "You're Americans?"
"Sure." "I've been there," he said, 40 years ago.
He was an old man, as brown as the others, with the stubble of a white beard.
"How was it?"
"What do you say?"
"How was America?"
"Oh, I was in California. It was fine."
"Why did you leave?"
"What do you say?"
"Why did you come back here?"
"Oh, I come back to get married. I was going to go back, but my wife, she don't like to travel."
"Where are you from?"
"Kansas City." "I've been there," he said. "I've been in Chicago, St. Louis, Kansas City, Denver, Los Angeles, Salt Lake City."
He named them carefully. "How long were you over?"
15 years. "Then I come back and got married."
"Have a drink?"
"All right," he said. "You can't get this in America, eh?"
"There's plenty if you can pay for it."
"What do you come over here for?"
"We're going to the fiesta at Pamplona."
"You like the bullfights?"
"Sure, don't you?"
"Yes," he said, "I guess I like them."
Then after a little,
"Where are you going now?"
"Up to Borgate to fish."
"Well," he said, "I hope you catch something."
He shook hands and turned around to the back seat again. The other Basques had been impressed. He sat back comfortably and smiled at me when I turned around to look at the country. But the effort of talking American seemed to have tired him. He did not say anything after that. The bus climbed steadily up the road. The country was barren and rocks stuck up through the clay. There was no grass beside the road. Looking back, we could see the country spread out below. Far back, the fields were squares of green and brown on the hillsides. Making the horizon were the brown mountains. They were strangely shaped. As we climbed higher, the horizon kept changing. As the bus ground slowly up the road, we could see other mountains coming up in the south. Then the road came over the crest, flattened out, and went into a forest. It was a forest of cork oaks, and the sun came through the trees in patches, and there were cattle grazing back in the trees. We went through the forest, and the road came out and turned along a rise of land, and out ahead of us was a rolling green plain with dark mountains beyond it. These were not like the brown, heat-baked mountains we had left behind. These were wooded, and there were clouds coming down from them. The green plain stretched off. It was cut by fences, and the white of the road showed through the trunks of a double line of trees that crossed the plain toward the north. As we came to the edge of the rise, we saw the red roofs and white houses of Borgate ahead strung out on the plain, and away off on the shoulder of the first dark mountain was the gray metal-sheathed roof of the monastery of Roncesvalles.
"There's Roncevaux," I said.
"Where?"
"Way off there where the mountain starts."
"It's cold up here," Bill said.
"It's high," I said. "It must be 1,200 meters.
"It's awfully cold," Bill said.
The bus leveled down onto the straight line of road that ran to Borgate. We passed a crossroads and crossed a bridge over a stream. The houses of Borgate were along both sides of the road. There were no side streets. We passed the church and the schoolyard, and the bus stopped. We got down, and the driver handed down our bags and the rod case. A carabiner in his cocked hat and yellow leather cross straps came up.
"What's in there?"
He pointed to the rod case. I opened it and showed him. He asked to see our fishing permits, and I got them out. He looked at the date and then waved us on.
"Is that all right?" I asked. "Yes, of course."
We went up the street, past the whitewashed stone houses, families sitting in their doorways watching us, to the inn. The fat woman who ran the inn came out from the kitchen and shook hands with us. She took off her spectacles, wiped them, and put them on again. It was cold in the inn, and the wind was starting to blow outside. The woman sent a girl upstairs with us to show the room. There were two beds, a washstand, a clothes chest, and a big framed steel engraving of Nuestra Señora de Roncesvalles. The wind was blowing against the shutters. The room was on the north side of the inn. We washed, put on sweaters, and came downstairs into the dining room. It had a stone floor, low ceiling, and was oak-paneled. The shutters were all up, and it was so cold you could see your breath.
"My God," said Bill, "it can't be this cold tomorrow. I'm not going to wade a stream in this weather."
There was an upright piano in the far corner of the room beyond the wooden tables, and Bill went over and started to play.
"I gotta keep warm," he said.
I went out to find the woman and asked her how much the room and board was. She put her hands under her apron and looked away from me.
12 pesetas.
"Why, we only paid that in Pamplona."
She did not say anything, just took off her glasses and wiped them on her apron.
"That's too much," I said. "We didn't pay more than that at a big hotel."
"We've put in a bathroom."
"Haven't you got anything cheaper?"
"Not in the summer. Now is the big season."
We were the only people in the inn.
"Well," I thought, "it's only a few days."
"Is the wine included?"
"Oh, yes."
"Well," I said, "it's all right." I went back to Bill. He blew his breath at me to show how cold it was and went on playing. I sat at one of the tables and looked at the pictures on the wall. There was one panel of rabbits, dead, one of pheasants, also dead, and one panel of dead ducks. The panels were all dark and smoky-looking. There was a cupboard full of liqueur bottles. I looked at them all. Bill was still playing.
"How about a hot rum punch?" he said. "This isn't going to keep me warm permanently."
I went out and told the woman what a rum punch was and how to make it. In a few minutes, a girl brought a stone pitcher, steaming, into the room. Bill came over from the piano, and we drank the hot punch and listened to the wind.
"There isn't too much rum in that."
I went over to the cupboard and brought the rum bottle and poured a half tumbler full into the pitcher.
"Direct action," said Bill. "It beats legislation."
The girl came in and laid the table for supper.
"It blows like hell up here," Bill said.
The girl brought in a big bowl of hot vegetable soup and the wine. We had fried trout afterward and some sort of a stew and a big bowl full of wild strawberries. We did not lose money on the wine, and the girl was shy but nice about bringing it. The old woman looked in once and counted the empty bottles. After supper, we went upstairs and smoked and read in bed to keep warm. Once in the night I woke and heard the wind blowing. It felt good to be warm and in bed.
Chapter 12.
When I woke in the morning, I went to the window and looked out. It had cleared and there were no clouds on the mountains. Outside, under the window, were some carts and an old diligence, the wood of the roof cracked and split by the weather. It must have been left from the days before the motor buses. A goat hopped up on one of the carts and then to the roof of the diligence. He jerked his head at the other goats below, and when I waved at him, he bounded down. Bill was still sleeping, so I dressed, put on my shoes outside in the hall, and went downstairs. No one was stirring downstairs, so I unbolted the door and went out. It was cool outside in the early morning, and the sun had not yet dried the dew that had come when the wind died down. I hunted around in the shed behind the inn and found a sort of mattock, and went down toward the stream to try and dig some worms for bait. The stream was clear and shallow, but it did not look trouty. On the grassy bank, where it was damp, I drove the mattock into the earth and loosened a chunk of sod. There were worms underneath. They slid out of sight as I lifted the sod, and I dug carefully and got a good many. Digging at the edge of the damp ground, I filled two empty tobacco tins with worms and sifted dirt onto them. The goats watched me dig. When I went back into the inn, the woman was down in the kitchen, and I asked her to get coffee for us, and that we wanted a lunch. Bill was awake and sitting on the edge of the bed.
"I saw you out of the window," he said. "Didn't want to interrupt you. What were you doing, burying your money?"
"You lazy bum."
"Been working for the common good? Splendid. I want you to do that every morning."
"Come on," I said. "Get up."
"What? Get up? I never get up."
He climbed into bed and pulled the sheet up to his chin.
"Try and argue me into getting up."
I went on looking for the tackle and putting it all together in the tackle bag.
"Aren't you interested?" Bill asked.
"I'm going down and eat."
"Eat? Why didn't you say eat? I thought you just wanted me to get up for fun."
"Eat? Fine. Now you're reasonable. You go out and dig some more worms and I'll be right down."
"Oh, go to hell."
"Work for the good of all." Bill stepped into his underclothes.
"Show irony and pity."
I started out of the room with the tackle bag, the nets, and the rod case.
"Hey, come back!"
I put my head in the door.
"Aren't you going to show a little irony and pity?"
I thumbed my nose.
"That's not irony."
As I went downstairs, I heard Bill singing, "Irony and pity when you're feeling, oh, give them irony and give them pity. Oh, give them irony when they're feeling, just a little irony, just a little pity." He kept on singing until he came downstairs. The tune was "The Bells Are Ringing for Me and My Gal." I was reading a week-old Spanish paper. "What's all this irony and pity?" "What? Don't you know about irony and pity?" "No, who got it up?" "Everybody. They're mad about it in New York. It's just like the Fratellinis used to be." The girl came in with the coffee and buttered toast. Or rather, it was bread, toasted, and buttered. "Ask her if she's got any jam," Bill said. "Be ironical with her." "Have you got any jam?" "That's not ironical. I wish I could talk Spanish." The coffee was good, and we drank it out of big bowls. The girl brought in a glass dish of raspberry jam. "Thank you." "Hey, that's not the way," Bill said. "Say something ironical. Make some crack about Primo de Rivera." I could ask her what kind of a jam they think they've gotten into in the riff. "Poor," said Bill, "very poor. You can't do it, that's all. You don't understand irony. You have no pity. Say something pitiful." "Robert Cohn." "Not so bad, that's better. Now, why is Cohn pitiful? Be ironic." He took a big gulp of coffee. "Oh, hell," I said, "it's too early in the morning." "There you go. And you claim you want to be a writer, too. You're only a newspaper man, an expatriated newspaper man. You ought to be ironical the minute you get out of bed. You ought to wake up with your mouth full of pity." "Go on," I said. "Who did you get this stuff from?" "Everybody. Don't you read? Don't you ever see anybody? You know what you are? You're an expatriate. Why don't you live in New York? Then you'd know these things. What do you want me to do, come over here and tell you every year?" "Take some more coffee," I said. "Good. Coffee is good for you. It's the caffeine in it. Caffeine, we are here. Caffeine puts a man on her horse and a woman in his grave. You know, it's the trouble with you. You're an expatriate. One of the worst type. Haven't you heard that? Nobody that ever left their own country ever wrote anything worth printing, not even in the newspapers." He drank the coffee. "You're an expatriate. You've lost touch with the soil. You get precious. Fake European standards have ruined you. You drink yourself to death. You become obsessed by sex. You spend all your time talking, not working. You're an expatriate, see? You hang around cafes." "It sounds like a swell life," I said. "When do I work?" "You don't work. One group claims women support you. Another group claims you're impotent." "No," I said, "I just had an accident." "Never mention that," Bill said. "That's the sort of thing that can't be spoken of. That's what you ought to work up into a mystery, like Henry's bicycle." He had been going splendidly, but he stopped. I was afraid he had thought he had hurt me with that crack about being impotent. I wanted to start him again. "It wasn't a bicycle," I said. "He was riding horseback." "I heard it was a tricycle." "Well," I said, "a plane is sort of like a tricycle. The joystick works the same way." "But you don't pedal it." "No," I said, "I guess you don't pedal it." "Well, let's lay off that," Bill said. "All right, I was just standing up for the tricycle." "I think he's a good rider, too," Bill said. "And you're a hell of a good guy. Anybody ever tell you you were a good guy?" "I'm not a good guy." "Listen, you're a hell of a good guy, and I'm fonder of you than anybody on earth." "I couldn't tell you that in New York. It'd mean I was a faggot. That was what the Civil War was about. Abraham Lincoln was a faggot. He was in love with General Grant. So was Jefferson Davis. Lincoln just freed the slaves on a bet. The Dred Scott case was framed by the Anti-Saloon League. Sex explains it all. The Colonel's lady and Judy O'Grady are lesbians under their skin." He stopped. "Want to hear some more?" "Shoot," I said. "I don't know any more. Tell you some more at lunch." "Old Bill," I said. "You bum." We packed the lunch and two bottles of wine in the rucksack, and Bill put it on. I carried the rod case and the landing nets slung over my back. We started up the road and then went across a meadow and found a path that crossed the fields and went toward the woods on the slope of the first hill. We walked across the fields on the sandy path. The fields were rolling and grassy, and the grass was short from the sheep grazing. The cattle were up in the hills. We heard their bells in the woods. The path crossed a stream on a foot log. The log was surfaced off, and there was a sapling bent across for a rail. In the flat pool beside the stream, tadpoles spotted the sand. We went up a steep bank and across the rolling fields. Looking back, we saw Borghete, white houses and red roofs, and the white road with a truck going along it and the dust rising. Beyond the fields, we crossed another faster-flowing stream. The sandy road led down to the ford and beyond into the woods. The path crossed the stream on another footlog below the ford and joined the road, and we went into the woods. It was a beech wood, and the trees were very old. Their roots bulked above the ground, and the branches were twisted. We walked on the road between the thick trunks of the old beeches, and the sunlight came through the leaves in light patches on the grass. The trees were big, and the foliage was thick, but it was not gloomy. There was no undergrowth, only the smooth grass, very green and fresh, and the big gray trees well spaced as though it were a park.
"This is country," Bill said.
The road went up a hill, and we got into thick woods, and the road kept on climbing. Sometimes it dipped down, but rose again steeply. All the time we heard the cattle in the woods. Finally the road came out on the top of the hills. We were on the top of the height of land that was the highest part of the range of wooded hills we had seen from Borghete. There were wild strawberries growing on the sunny side of the ridge and a little clearing in the trees. Ahead the road came out of the forest and went along the shoulder of the ridge of hills. The hills ahead were not wooded, and there were great fields of yellow gorse. Way off we saw the steep bluffs, dark with trees and jutting with gray stone, that marked the course of the Irati River. "We have to follow this road along the ridge, cross these hills, go through the woods on the far hills, and come down to the Irati Valley," I pointed out to Bill.
"That's a hell of a hike.
It's too far to go and fish and come back the same day, comfortably."
"Comfortably? That's a nice word. We'll have to go like hell to get there and back and have any fishing at all."
It was a long walk, and the country was very fine, but we were tired when we came down the steep road that led out of the wooded hills into the valley of the Rio de la Fabrica. The road came out from the shadow of the woods into the hot sun. Ahead was a river valley. Beyond the river was a steep hill. There was a field of buckwheat on the hill. We saw a white house under some trees on the hillside. It was very hot, and we stopped under some trees beside a dam that crossed the river. Bill put the pack against one of the trees, and we jointed up the rods, put on the reels, tied on leaders, and got ready to fish.
"You're sure this thing has trout in it?" Bill asked.
"It's full of them.
I'm going to fish a fly. You got any McGinty's?"
"There's some in there."
"You going to fish bait?"
"Yeah, I'm going to fish the dam here."
"Well, I'll take the fly book, then."
He tied on a fly.
"Where'd I better go, up or down?"
"Down is best. There are plenty up above, too." Bill went down the bank.
"Take a worm can."
"No, I don't want one. If they won't take a fly, I'll just flick it around." Bill was down below watching the stream.
"Say," he called up against the noise of the dam, "how about putting the wine in that spring up the road?"
"All right," I shouted. Bill waved his hand and started down the stream. I found the two wine bottles in the pack and carried them up the road to where the water of a spring flowed out of an iron pipe. There was a board over the spring, and I lifted it and, knocking the corks firmly into the bottles, lowered them down into the water. It was so cold my hand and wrist felt numbed. I put back the slab of wood and hoped nobody would find the wine. I got my rod that was leaning against the tree, took the bait can and landing net, and walked out onto the dam. It was built to provide a head of water for driving logs. The gate was up, and I sat on one of the squared timbers and watched the smooth apron of water before the river tumbled into the falls. In the white water at the foot of the dam, it was deep. As I baited up, a trout shot up out of the white water into the falls and was carried down. Before I could finish baiting, another trout jumped at the falls, making the same lovely arc and disappearing into the water that was thundering down. I put on a good-sized sinker and dropped into the white water close to the edge of the timbers of the dam. I did not feel the first trout strike. When I started to pull up, I felt that I had one and brought him, fighting and bending the rod almost double, out of the boiling water at the foot of the falls and swung him up and onto the dam. He was a good trout, and I banged his head against the timber so that he quivered out straight and then slipped him into my bag. While I had him on, several trout had jumped at the falls. As soon as I baited up and dropped in again, I hooked another and brought him in the same way. In a little while I had six. They were all about the same size. I laid them out side by side, all their heads pointing the same way, and looked at them. They were beautifully colored and firm and hard from the cold water. It was a hot day, so I split them all and shucked out the insides, gills and all, and tossed them over across the river. I took the trout ashore, washed them in the cold, smoothly heavy water above the dam, and then picked some ferns and packed them all in the bag, three trout on a layer of ferns, then another layer of ferns, then three more trout, and then covered them with ferns. They looked nice in the ferns, and now the bag was bulky, and I put it in the shade of the tree. It was very hot on the dam, so I put my worm can in the shade with the bag, and got a book out of the pack and settled down under the tree to read until Bill should come up for lunch. It was a little past noon, and there was not much shade, but I sat against the trunk of two of the trees that grew together and read. The book was something by A.E.W. Mason, and I was reading a wonderful story about a man who had been frozen in the Alps and then fallen into a glacier and disappeared, and his bride was going to wait 24 years exactly for his body to come out on the moraine, while her true love waited too. And they were still waiting when Bill came up. "Get any?" he asked. He had his rod and his bag and his net all in one hand, and he was sweating. I hadn't heard him come up because of the noise from the dam. "Six. What did you get?" Bill sat down, opened up his bag, and laid a big trout on the grass. He took out three more, each one a little bigger than the last, and laid them side by side in the shade from the tree. His face was sweaty and happy. "How are yours?"
"Smaller."
"Let's see them."
"They're packed."
"How big are they, really?"
"They're all about the size of your smallest."
"You're not holding out on me."
"I wish I were."
"Get them all on worms?"
"Yes."
"You lazy bum."
Bill put the trout in the bag and started for the river, swinging the open bag. He was wet from the waist down, and I knew he must have been wading the stream. I walked up the road and got out the two bottles of wine. They were cold. Moisture beaded on the bottles as I walked back to the trees. I spread the lunch on a newspaper and uncorked one of the bottles and leaned the other against a tree. Bill came up drying his hands, his bag plump with ferns.
"Let's see that bottle," he said.
He pulled the cork and tipped up the bottle and drank.
"Phew! That makes my eyes ache."
"Let's try it." The wine was icy cold and tasted faintly rusty.
"That's not such filthy wine," Bill said.
"The cold helps it," I said. We unwrapped the little parcels of lunch.
"Chicken? There's hard-boiled eggs."
"Find any salt?"
"First the egg," said Bill, "then the chicken. Even Brian could see that."
"He's dead. I read it in the paper yesterday."
"No, not really."
"Yes, Brian's dead." Bill laid down the egg he was peeling.
"Gentlemen," he said, and unwrapped a drumstick from a piece of newspaper, "I reverse the order, for Brian's sake, as a tribute to the great commoner. First the chicken, then the egg."
"Wonder what day God created the chicken?"
"Oh," said Bill, sucking the drumstick, "how should we know? We should not question. Our stay on earth is not for long. Let us rejoice and believe and give thanks."
"Eat an egg." Bill gestured with the drumstick in one hand and the bottle of wine in the other.
"Let us rejoice in our blessings. Let us utilize the fowls of the air. Let us utilize the product of the vine. Will you utilize a little, brother?"
"After you, brother."
Bill took a long drink. "Utilize a little, brother." He handed me the bottle. "Let us not doubt, brother. Let us not pry into the holy mysteries of the hen coop with simian fingers. Let us accept on faith and simply say, I want you to join with me in saying, what shall we say, brother?"
He pointed the drumstick at me and went on.
"Let me tell you, we will say, and I for one am proud to say, and I want you to say with me on your knees, brother, let no man be ashamed to kneel here in the great out of doors. Remember, the woods were God's first temples. Let us kneel and say, don't eat that lady, that's Mencken."
"Here," I said, "utilize a little of this."
We uncorked the other bottle.
"What's the matter?" I said. "Didn't you like Brian?"
"I loved Brian," said Bill. "We were like brothers."
"Where did you know him?"
"He and Mankin and I all went to Holy Cross together."
"And Frankie Fritsch?"
"It's a lie. Frankie Fritsch went to Fordham."
"Well," I said, "I went to Loyola with Bishop Manning."
"It's a lie," Bill said. "I went to Loyola with Bishop Manning myself."
"You're cockeyed," I said.
"On wine?"
"Why not?"
"It's the humidity," Bill said.
"They ought to take this damn humidity away."
"Have another shot."
"Is this all we've got?"
"Only the two bottles."
"Do you know what you are?"
Bill looked at the bottle affectionately.
"No," I said.
"You're in the pay of the Anti-Saloon League."
"I went to Notre Dame with Wayne B. Wheeler."
"It's a lie," said Bill.
"I went to Austin Business College with Wayne B. Wheeler. He was class president."
"Well," I said, "the saloon must go."
"You're right there, old classmate," Bill said. "The saloon must go, and I will take it with me."
"You're cockeyed."
"On wine?"
"On wine."
"Well, maybe I am."
"Want to take a nap?"
"All right."
We lay with our heads in the shade and looked up into the trees.
"You asleep?"
"No," Bill said. "I was thinking."
I shut my eyes. It felt good lying on the ground.
"Say," Bill said, "what about this Brett business?"
"What about it?"
"Were you ever in love with her?"
"Sure."
"For how long?"
"Off and on, for a hell of a long time."
"Oh, hell," Bill said. "I'm sorry, fella."
"It's all right," I said. "I don't give a damn anymore."
"Really?"
"Really. Only I'd a hell of a lot rather not talk about it."
"You aren't sore I asked you."
"Why the hell should I be?"
"I'm going to sleep," Bill said.
He put a newspaper over his face.
"Listen, Jake," he said, "are you really a Catholic?"
"Technically."
"What does that mean?"
"I don't know."
"All right, I'll go to sleep now," he said. "Don't keep me awake by talking so much."
I went to sleep, too. When I woke up, Bill was packing the rucksack. It was late in the afternoon, and the shadow from the trees was long and went out over the dam. I was stiff from sleeping on the ground.
"What'd you do, wake up?" Bill asked. "Why didn't you spend the night?"
I stretched and rubbed my eyes.
"I had a lovely dream," Bill said. "I don't remember what it was about, but it was a lovely dream."
"I don't think I dreamt."
"You ought to dream," Bill said. "All our biggest businessmen have been dreamers. Look at Ford. Look at President Coolidge. Look at Rockefeller. Look at Joe Davidson."
I disjointed my rod and Bill's and packed them in the rod case. I put the reels in the tackle bag. Bill had packed the rucksack, and we put one of the trout bags in. I carried the other.
"Well," said Bill, "have we got everything?"
"The worms.
Your worms. Put them in there."
He had the pack on his back, and I put the worm cans in one of the outside flap pockets.
"You got everything now?"
I looked around on the grass at the foot of the elm trees.
"Yes."
We started up the road into the woods. It was a long walk home to Borghete, and it was dark when we came down across the fields to the road, and along the road between the houses of the town, their windows lighted, to the inn. We stayed 5 days at Borghete and had good fishing. The nights were cold and the days were hot, and there was always a breeze, even in the heat of the day. It was hot enough so that it felt good to wade in a cold stream, and the sun dried you when you came out and sat on the bank. We found a stream with a pool deep enough to swim in. In the evenings, we played three-handed bridge with an Englishman named Harris, who had walked over from Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port and was stopping at the inn for the fishing. He was very pleasant and went with us twice to the Irati River. There was no word from Robert Cohn, nor from Brett and Mike.
Chapter 13.
One morning I went down to breakfast, and the Englishman, Harris, was already at the table. He was reading the paper through spectacles. He looked up and smiled.
"Good morning," he said. Letter for you. I stopped at the post and they gave it me with mine.
The letter was at my place at the table, leaning against a coffee cup. Harris was reading the paper again. I opened the letter. It had been forwarded from Pamplona. It was dated San Sebastian, Sunday. Dear Jake, we got here Friday. Brett passed out on the train, so brought her here for 3 days' rest with old friends of ours. We go to Montoya Hotel, Pamplona, Tuesday, arriving at I don't know what hour. We'll send a note by the bus to tell us what to do to rejoin you all on Wednesday. All our love and sorry to be late, but Brett was really done in and will be quite all right by Tuesday, and is practically so now. I know her so well and try to look after her, but it's not so easy. Love to all the chaps. Michael.
What day of the week is it? I asked Harris.
Wednesday, I think. Yes, quite, Wednesday. Wonderful how one loses track of the days up here in the mountains.
Yes, we've been here nearly a week.
I hope you're not thinking of leaving.
Yes, we'll go in on the afternoon bus, I'm afraid.
What a rotten business. I'd hoped we'd all have another go at the Errati together.
We have to go into Pamplona. We're meeting people there.
What rotten luck for me. We've had a jolly time here at Borghete.
Come on into Pamplona. We can play some bridge there, and there's going to be a damned fine fiesta.
I'd like to. Awfully nice of you to ask me. I'd best stop on here, though. I've not much more time to fish.
You want those big ones in the Errati?
I say I do, you know. They're enormous trout there.
I'd like to try them once more.
Do. Stop over another day. Be a good chap.
We really have to get into town, I said.
What a pity.
After breakfast, Bill and I were sitting warming in the sun on a bench out in front of the inn and talking it over. I saw a girl coming up the road from the center of the town. She stopped in front of us and took a telegram out of the leather wallet that hung against her skirt.
Por ustedes?
I looked at it. The address was Barnes, Borghete.
Yes, it's for us.
She brought out a book for me to sign, and I gave her a couple of coppers. The telegram was in Spanish.
Vengo jueves con.
I handed it to Bill.
What does the word cone mean? He asked.
What a lousy telegram, I said.
He could send 10 words for the same price. I come Thursday. That gives you a lot of dope, doesn't it?
It gives you all the dope that's of interest to Cone.
We're going in anyway, I said. There's no use trying to move Brett and Mike out here and back before the fiesta. Should we answer it?
We might as well, said Bill. There's no need for us to be snooty.
We walked up to the post office and asked for a telegraph blank.
What will we say? Bill asked.
Arriving tonight, that's enough. We paid for the message and walked back to the inn. Harris was there, and the three of us walked up to Roncesvalles. We went through the monastery.
It's a remarkable place, Harris said when we came out. But you know I'm not much on those sort of places.
Me either, Bill said.
It's a remarkable place, though, Harris said. I wouldn't not have seen it. I'd been intending coming up each day.
It isn't the same as fishing, though, is it? Bill asked.
He liked Harris.
I say not.
We were standing in front of the old chapel of the monastery.
Isn't that a pub across the way? Harris asked. Or do my eyes deceive me?
It has the look of a pub, Bill said.
Well, looks to me like a pub, I said.
I say, said Harris, let's utilize it.
He had taken up utilizing from Bill.
We had a bottle of wine apiece. Harris would not let us pay. He talked Spanish quite well, and the innkeeper would not take our money.
I say, you don't know what it's meant to me to have you chaps up here.
We've had a grand time, Harris.
Harris was a little tight.
I say, really, you don't know how much it means. I've not had much fun since the war.
We'll all fish together again sometime, don't you forget it, Harris.
We must. We have had such a jolly good time.
This book is continued on Disc 4.